All right. Good morning, everybody. We'll get started. Hi, everyone. I'm Troy Swanson. I'm one of the librarians at Moraine Valley, and I am thrilled to welcome you to this panel discussion, which is organized by Moraine Valley's Democracy Commitment and also by the library. Today, we are talking about and trying to understand the events of January 6th to January 20th, 2021, and what a month it has been. Undoubtedly, these past weeks will be remembered as important moments in the history of the United States. We want to address how we have reached these unthinkable ends and hopefully how we can move forward. Before I introduce our panel members, I want to give a short summary of events for everyone who may have lost track. So if you've been living under a rock, here's what you missed. On January 6th, a violent attack against the 117th United States Congress took place at the United States Capitol. It was carried out by a mob of supporters of then President Donald Trump in an open attempt to overturn his defeat in the 2020 presidential election. President Trump had been laying the groundwork to overturn his election since August of 2020 and throughout the fall election season. This culminated on January 6th with the quote, "Save America," unquote rally at the Ellipse near the White House. At this event, Trump claimed without evidence that the election had been stolen, and former New York mayor and Trump advisor Rudy Giuliani called for, quote, "trial by combat." Following this event, thousands of Trump supporters marched on the Capitol, where they breached police perimeters, broke down windows and doors, and assaulted law enforcement who attempted to keep the crowd at bay. The insurgents ransacked the Capitol as law enforcement rushed to protect members of the House and Senate who were meeting in a joint session to certify the Electoral College votes and officially recognize Joseph Biden as the next president. The rioters occupied the Capitol building, looted offices, and they took selfies on the Senate floor. Dozens of people were injured in this attack, and five people, including Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, died from the events. Later that evening, the members of Congress reconvened to certify the election, and they expressed their outrage at this attack. Over the next week, hundreds of people were charged by federal authorities, all of whom currently await trial. Additionally, one week later, on January 13th, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 232 to 197 to impeach Donald Trump for a second time. Notably, 10 Republicans voted with all of the Democrats in favor of impeachment. Then, on January 20th, under extremely high levels of security due to continued threats, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were sworn in as president and vice president. In the ceremonial events of Inauguration Day, efforts were made to condemn the attacks on the Capitol while also demonstrating the unity of our country. A notable moment came when former Presidents George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama released a video pledging to support Biden, for their support of the Biden administration. It has been, needless to say, a whirlwind month of January. To discuss all of this, I am very excited to be joined by two faculty members. First off, Kevin Navratil, who is really the organizer of this event. So thanks for your work, Kevin. Kevin is a professor of political science and the coordinator of the Democracy Commitment at Moraine Valley. And also, we're joined by Dr. Jeremy Shermack, who's a professor of journalism at Orange Coast College in Costa Mesa, California, where he is also the coordinator of their college newspaper. We were supposed to be joined also by Dr. Amy Williamson from psychology, but due to a small family emergency, Amy is unable to join us. So we are sorry, and we're going to try to not necessarily talk to psychologists, but kind of fill in some of the ideas that Amy was going to share. I'm grateful for both of you for joining me. It's difficult to get everybody together in this early part of the semester. I mean, we're just getting started in the term, and so but we didn't want to let time go on too much, let these events get too far in the past. So welcome to our audience. Thank you all for joining me. And enough of me talking. I want to get you both to jump in here. I'd like to just ask for a very short, just kind of, overall reaction to this month that we've been living through. So Kevin, as the organizer, maybe you can start us off.
Thanks, Troy, and thanks so much for leading this today. And thanks, Jeremy, for a reunion of sorts. That Jeremy used to be a professor at Moraine, I don't know, a long time ago, close to a decade ago. So it's good to have you back. So, hopefully today is a boring Wednesday compared to the last three of insurrection, impeachment, and an inauguration. I was just gutted that day. I had communicated with many people for several years that I was worried that something violent could happen in the United States. I didn't envision that scenario. And as it unfolded, I was just emotionally gutted. Of all my years of following politics, you know, it was a 9/11 type day where you didn't know how this was going to end. I had my 4-year-old daughter, and I didn't know what to tell her. I had to keep watching this. I didn't know how to explain it to her. I guess a couple just big picture thoughts that I had. For two decades, we've had so many, you know, millions of Americans who have served overseas, you know, fighting terrorism, making us safe, helping Iraq and Afghanistan with security and elections. And to see that unfold at our heart of our own democracy, just the symbolic nature of that, and to find out that of the people who have been arrested for the Capitol insurrection, like 20% of them are former military, is just really gutting, and I think really worthy of analysis and understanding of how we got there. And then the other big takeaway that I have in trying to use kind of a sports analogy, just because I'm really worried, I've been worried about the degradation of norms, political norms that we've been having in our country for quite some time. But the three of us all like sports, and many people can relate to sports. And just thinking about if we viewed all play-by-play commentators as fake announcers, if the refs were part of the deep state, if the scorekeeping is rigged and we don't agree to abide by the results, if only the penalties against our opponents should count, if our opponent is evil and should be destroyed, not just beaten, you know, going forward, we're going to have some agreed upon rules. We've had these rules for 230 years of peaceful transition of power and abiding by the election results. So they're not new norms, but making sure that truth matters, making sure that, you know, we play by the democratic playbook, I think is going to be really key. And I've gone over my 2 minutes, so I'll stop there.
First off, thank you, Troy, and Kevin as well, for inviting me here. I'm really happy to be here. It's good to be back with my Moraine peeps. So I think for me, and I really love the sports analogy that Kevin mentioned, and I think we'll get back to that as we go throughout the day. But for me, it was gutting is a good word for it. It was also very, I think, in a way, traumatizing. There is a certain level of comfort that I think Americans see, and I'm speaking for myself, when you see the Capitol and you see that building standing there and all the things inside of it. If you've ever had the chance to go and see it, you understand all the what it represents. It represents the democracy that we hold very dear, and I think oftentimes take for granted. And to see it overrun that day was stunning and striking and frightening. Being a journalism professor and working as a journalist myself, it was also that day for me something that is just etched in my mind, many different images, but was something that was written on a door going into the Capitol, and that was, it said, "Murder the media, murder the media." And I saw that day, and it really got me thinking. And it was quite emotional for me, quite honestly, thinking, how do I turn around in class and talk to my students about this? How do I encourage my students to go out into a profession that is under such attack? And later throughout the day and that week, images emerged of these rioters destroying equipment from media equipment. There was a setup from the Associated Press that they just bashed and destroyed and crushed. There was, video of them following around reporters, and sort of once they were identified as media, they were chased around essentially and run off the grounds. And this is very scary, and it really represents this idea that has taken, unfortunately, such a stronghold on a certain sector of our political spectrum that, you know, the media is the enemy of the people. And the truth is that the media is a critical part of democracy. The media is not the enemy of the people. It is the people and designed to represent the people. And does it always work that way? No. Does it always work perfectly like that? Absolutely not. But that was a really glaring thing for me that day, was just the relentless attack on journalists and on journalism in general.
Yeah. Thank you both. I think a thing that I would just add that, yes, it was like shocking, and I never thought it would go to this in the United States of America, but there was also this like underlying feeling that this was a logical outcome of where we've been going for a number of years, like not just the Trump administration, but longer. Like, of course, this is where we're going to end up. And I think that's the thing that should scare us most. And that's what we're going to talk about here off the bat. Let me also say for our audience members, there's a question in the Q&A asking if we can ask questions. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that. Yes, please, if you have questions, throw them up in the Q&A and we'll try to get to them. I'll be watching to try to fit them in as we can. So let's just start out then talking about how we got to that moment of January 6th. Siva Vaidyanathan, who's a scholar of media studies at the University of Virginia, has said that we are living in a global crisis. He said that we have re-networked our communication infrastructure so that we are living in a world driven by, quote, the digital equivalent of cults, unquote. Those are his words. These cults are driven by the power of belief that has heavy emotion and alienation behind them. Can you talk about how the attack on the Capitol represents a cult-like action?
So I'll start with that, if I may. I think something that is important, if you think about, you know, what a cult is, right? And you know, it's a, and there's, I know there's more, there's fancier psychological definitions of this, and I'm Kevin could probably add more too, but I think in a sense, when you think about a cult in a communications sense, where, you know, typically it involves a very central thought leader or thought leaders who are, distributing messages to followers that then provokes a very, I guess, strong reaction or very strong actions. And I think that's something that we saw. Now, it's hard for me to sit and say that, you know, everyone that voted for Trump is part of the cult. All right. I don't think that's true necessarily. However, it does enable those who take it to that extreme to participate in these cult-like behaviors. And when you have folks buying into the message so much, and if we're isolating this incident, the message was what everyone's calling the big lie right now, with a big lie about stealing the election. So they bought into this big lie that the election was stolen, and then acted upon it. And now what's very interesting that's coming out, now that there are arrests being made and there are court documents being filed, many of those who are being arrested are being interviewed and being asked, why did you do it? And a lot of them are saying, because the president told me so, because I was listening to my president. And that indicates a level of cult behavior that's really troubling. And, you know, we saw it at an extreme at the Capitol. But if you think about that trickling down, right, to, you know, media habits or, you know, policy decisions or just, you know, general political decisions on an everyday basis, that power is there. And I think it's there now more than it ever has been in our country. So that's where I see the messaging is really where I see the cult behavior and those relationships there.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, not exactly my area of expertise with understanding cult-like behavior, but just in looking at political parties having long-standing agendas and policy priorities and principles. So just to backtrack for a moment, this big lie about the election being stolen would require so many thousands of people to act in coordination between poll workers, you know, election officials, Republican Secretary of States, Republican governors, judges who were appointed by President Trump. The list goes on and on. And, you know, there were 60 court cases that that all failed, who, you know, were rejected. So that level of belief in something that doesn't have any evidence to support it is really troubling. And for people to act upon that, you know, there are examples of that, I think, in cult-like behavior. And what I was saying about earlier about the traditional, let's say, political party values, I was thinking, you know, traditionally for Republicans, you know, free trade, being tough on adversaries, particularly Russia, you know, pro-constitution, pro rule of law. And many of those were, over the course of 4 years, really eroded for kind of the following of whatever Trump wanted the Republican leadership and followers to do. And to see that change over the course of 4 years and really how whatever he said went, regardless of the longstanding principles of the party, and how anybody who who didn't support that would just be attacked and vilified, ostracized. I mean, you had, you know, a war hero with John McCain, who was attacked and still attacked even after his death. And, you know, people like Jeff Flake and others. So that, I think, again, it's really going to take a deep analysis to understand the motivations of why people would be so strongly supportive of a person over a party or some of the longstanding principles. And I think we owe it to ourselves to understand those motivations.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the idea of this communication infrastructure being re-networked, I mean, it's also partly why we were so surprised, I think, because the people that I've heard from who are monitoring these different networks were not really surprised. They were surprised at the lack of police presence at the Capitol and the lack of seemingly awareness from the Capitol Police, because they were all like, hey, they've been talking about this for months. But it's like we're living in these two different worlds. And I think maybe that's more of the cult nature. Not that they are cults, like you guys have both said, but that they're like, we are building separate realities because we're networking ourselves together in unhealthy ways. You know, when I look at this insurgency, I mean, I just got to put it out there. I can't help but notice that a vast majority of the people who were doing this were white. Maybe not everybody, but I mean, a vast, vast majority, white men particularly. And so I just got to say it. And there were literally people who were white supremacists there. Famously, there's the man who was wearing the Camp Auschwitz shirt, which, by the way, today is National Holocaust Memorial Day, I believe, right? The liberation of Auschwitz. I think this is the anniversary today. Want to acknowledge that. So I want to ask you both, with these just these observations, what is the role of race in this attack?
Well, you know, I'll start off. There's a couple of different ways of looking at this as far as just the demographics of political party support and how people voted in 2016 and 2020. And it's been real clear that some of the groups of people who have supported Donald Trump in the highest proportion are white males without a college degree, rural areas, more likely to be religious, particularly Protestant. I think that if you look at some of the that's in a nutshell, it's white males. And you know, the group of people at the Capitol, from the videos I've watched, hours of videos and all kinds of images, there's certainly people from, you know, all races and ethnicities, but it's disproportionately white males. But I just wanted to point out, with that lack of college education more likely to support President Trump, it's also true that at least of the arrests of the people that we've identified, there's a lot of walks of life, you know, real estate agents, lawyers, firefighters, police officers, you know, people who served in the military, somebody in education, a teacher. It's clearly we can make these generalizations of demographics, but they're not destiny, right? There's clearly people from all various groups of our society who, and 74 million people who voted for President Trump. So again, I think it's important to dissect the various groups, you know, and that especially we're at the Capitol, the Proud Boys, QAnon, white nationalists, Nazis, but there's other people there too. And again, I think there just really needs to be a deep analysis of the motivations of why people may have participated in something like that.
And it's definitely true. It's undoubtedly true that it was a majority white male. And I think something that many of those who have tried to defend or, you know, somehow, I guess, defend those who, you know, started the insurrection was, you know, saying that, well, you know, you allowed the BLM, the Black Lives Matter protests in the summer, and they've drawn that comparison to those. And yes, there was violence associated with those, and there were, you know, there was property damage, and all those numbers have been cited. But this was such a very direct attack. And I think that it's important to recognize that and have that discussion, because it's hard to deny that if the majority of those folks who did rush the Capitol on January 6th were not white, things may have been very different. And that's a massive issue. But it's something that we need to consider, and probably goes far beyond the time that we have today and all the things we want to cover. But it's worth pointing out. That said, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean, again, all white males, I'm a white male, it doesn't necessarily mean all white males are feeling this way. But it is, as Kevin said, of a certain political demographic where you have, you know, non-college degrees or non-college educated white males tend to be a little bit more involved, it seems, in this. And the numbers that are interesting, I think, to look at are that tends to be the readership and the listenership of right-wing media. Is white male without a college degree tend to gravitate to that. So there's a lot of alignment there. This is not in any way knocking someone without a college degree. But the point is that those who we have been, you know, seeing consuming conservative media that has gone further to the fringe are the same folks that we saw anecdotally rushing the Capitol on January 6th. I don't think that is a coincidence.
I mean, this maybe is a too complicated of a question to really get into, but I'm going to ask anyways. You know, is political ideology just connected to identity? I mean, is that where we are?
Yeah, I mean, I'll let the political guy handle that one.
Well, I think it's tricky to fully. I think the traditional ideological spectrum has really been upended in recent years, let's say 5-10 years. But you know, because the traditional political ideologies would, you know, big government on the left, providing social services, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that typically require bigger taxes, providing, you know, ensuring equal treatment under the law, preventing against discrimination, as some of the key pillars. And on the right, you know, kind of a smaller government, limited government, lower taxes, you know, pro-life and free trade and strong against defense. And I think more recently, there's been globalism on the left of like, hey, we need to work with allies. We need to, issues are transnational in nature and it requires cooperation from various countries around the world to adequately address them. And you know, immigration has many benefits. We can bring the best and brightest into our country and you know, be stronger for it. Whereas on the right, more recently, it's been like kind of anti-free trade, more protectionism. This is in particular under Trump. Not all conservatives believe this. And then, of course, you know, you've gone from George W. Bush trying for immigration reform to really Trump outflanking all of his, what was it, 16 Republican competitors in the 2016 primary by being the most strict on immigration. So I think that it's harder to use the political ideological spectrum that we've been using for decades to fully analyze this moment. But that being said, back to the demographics, it's pretty clear that we've got a strong group of you know, the Democrats. Liberals tend to be more likely to be minority, more likely to be urban, living in urban areas, more likely to have a college degree, more likely to be female, less likely to be religious. But it's been clear in recent with recent polls for the last 5 years that college education or the lack thereof is a key difference. And this is new. That gap is widening. It's widened from 2016 to 2018 to 2020. And you know, Jeremy, I know you've mentioned before that partly the rural areas lacking, you know, broadband internet access and, you know, having talk radio as being one of the key ways for people to follow what's going on. So I think that's a part of it, of trying to understand the different information ecosystems that people are exposed to.
I want to just pause from our line of questions here and get in a couple of the questions that are in the Q&A. I want to start with, there's a question from Miriam that says, militant democracy that exists in the German constitution, could it have prevented this and prevented future actions like this if applied to a certain extent? Kevin, I'm not sure how your comparative politics is between the German Constitution and the U.S. Constitution, but is that something you can address?
Well, I think I can't fully, I'm winging it a little bit here, but various countries, because of their history, have, you know, much harsher restrictions on speech, and particularly that of hate speech and extremist groups. I know Germany, that I can say on the record, is that they have partly a proportional representation system, and they use a minimum of 5% to be able to have representation in their legislative body. And that's in part to limit extremist groups. They've particularly focused on, Nazi groups, far right groups, of being targeted, of not being able to have representation. So that's definitely different than the United States.
Okay. And there's a question from Rosmaya. I'm sorry if I'm butchering your name. How would you characterize the events of the insurrection and inauguration? Which I think we're kind of doing that in the big picture, but I wanted to get that in there. How would you characterize the events between the insurrection and the inauguration?
I guess I would say with that, I don't want to say that they're coincidental in their timing. Obviously, the plan, I think the plan and the reason why it took place on the 6th was because they were, certifying the election and counting the electoral votes. These things, that's typically the order and the way things operate. Correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, but so characterizing them, it seemed like an attempt to, the insurrection was an attempt to delay or stop that inauguration. That's really the primary relationship. But as Troy mentioned, we'll talk about that more broadly as we move through the day.
Yeah, I think, that was circled as kind of the final opportunity to disrupt the election results. Now, keep in mind, we had election week instead of election day. Actually, we had an election month or two before the election day because of so much early voting, which we've always had, and we've had mail-in voting. But of course, during a pandemic, we expanded that in many states, and states have the power to do that at the state level. And so it took a while to get the election results, in particular, a couple of, handful of close states in Wisconsin and in Arizona and Pennsylvania and Georgia. And so, there was efforts to target the certifications in those individual states. There was, clearly President Trump targeted election officials and the Secretary of State in Georgia. So there's a lot of different attempts to try to disrupt. But to Jeremy's point, that January 6th date of the certification, I think former President Trump was under the false belief that somehow the vice president had the power to not certify the election results from the states. And so from that time period, you mentioned from insurrection to inauguration, there was ultimately a vote to certify the election results. It's important to point out, we had over 100 and some Republicans who voted against certifying the election results. And then we had an impeachment, which was the week after the insurrection. The House voted on impeachment for President Trump inciting a riot. And I guess for now, I'll leave it at that. As far as what transpired, I just want to make sure that it's clear that there was, we often, in current events, there's so much going on that in between the insurrection and the inauguration, there was an impeachment.
I want to get in one more quick question from the audience, and then we'll keep moving down our discussion points. This is from Maria. Would you say it's likely that there is another attack against our democracy even after Trump has left office?
I would say it's still as likely. Personally, that's my opinion. I don't think that, I think that maybe him leaving office turned the temperature down nationally, but I still think, let me rephrase that, to turn the temperature down from what we can see nationally, because so often his rhetoric in the White House, when he was in the briefing room or on Twitter, raise that temperature. But I still think that there are those out there, those who are loyal to former President Trump, who are still and perhaps even more angry, and maybe even feel more emboldened by what they saw at the Capitol. You know, the Capitol insurrection or the attack on it wasn't the first that we've seen in recent months against Capitols. We had in the state of Michigan, it's my home state, so I was paying close attention to that. We had armed individuals entering the Capitol protesting COVID restrictions. I think December 20th or 21st of just this past year, just about a month ago, we had a storming of the Capitol in Oregon, in Salem. And so these are really, this is almost a pattern. And so, yes, I think I do think that, you know, the temperature is still high enough in this country where there could be another attack.
Yeah, I would echo Jeremy's point and, you know, add in Charlottesville. And of course, there was, you know, I mentioned earlier with riots and looting this summer for different reasons. But one of the reasons I'm so passionate about having events like this, and there'll be others like this going forward with the Democracy Commitment, is I'm truly concerned that we are looking at years of insurgency. You know, if you look at, I've watched a lot of the videos of the Capitol attack of some of the Proud Boys, and then I've watched, there's a PBS Frontline documentary on kind of the rise of the far right and extremist groups. Many of them, you know, Amanda Gorman said it great on the inauguration that, you know, that there's people who would rather shatter our democracy than share it. And I'm really, really concerned about some of the militia, you know, Proud Boys, extremist groups who they're willing to work as lone wolves in small groups. I think that it took 25,000-30,000 National Guard troops in DC to help prevent any disruption of the inauguration. That's scary, you know, that it took that kind of response. And I don't want to alarm people, but I also want us to be clear-eyed about the threats that we face. And I think it's a matter of if not when we have, I don't want to say similar type attacks as my Capitol, because that was a pretty unique situation. But to Jeremy's point, state capitals, elected officials being targeted of kidnapping or harming them in individual ways. I think we really need to dig deep and understand the challenges that we're going to be facing. And as one example, next month, we're going to have an event where one of our other professors, Mary Fafflis, looks at the troubles of Northern Ireland. And I just bring that up because I think that in many ways, we could be facing similar type domestic terrorism that's sporadic, that's constant. You know, it's not just going to be a few examples here and there, that it could be over the course of years. You know, when you don't believe the election was legitimate, in that, you know, nearly 40% or more of Republicans don't believe that, I'm sorry, it's actually more than that. When many Republicans don't view President Biden as a legitimate winner of the election, people can take it into their own hands. And I think it's on all of us to try to work to prevent that.
Yeah, it's something like 70 or 75% of Republicans, depending on which poll you follow. Okay, I want to get us down to the impeachment and the inauguration in a second. But I have one question for each of you. So I'm going to ask Kevin's question first, then I have a question for you, Jeremy, because I want to fast forward here a little bit. I just, you know, both of you have mentioned, so this is for you, Kevin, both of you have mentioned the summer 2020 Black Lives Matter protests. And I, you know, it's been mentioned, and I want to take this on directly because I've heard this from my friends on the right. So in the summer 2020, we saw protests across the United States sparked by the murder of a black man named George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. There's been a number of other police killings that sparked protests and violence. What is the difference between the looting and rioting this summer and what took place at the Capitol? As succinctly as you can give that to us.
Well, it's a great and important question. And I think one of the things that we have to, I'm going to take longer than I was assigned to answer that, but it often is referred to as whataboutism. And anytime that there is a charge against someone and they start saying, well, what about this or what about that? It's definitely a technique that they're using to, so if you try to, if we're trying to examine what happened at the Capitol and people say, well, what about happened this summer and what about the looting and rioting? It's a intentional effort to deflect any sort of responsibility in looking at the merits of that individual case and, you know, trying to just muddy the waters and deflect any sort of criticism. But if we're actually going to look at these two scenarios, and I think it's important to look at the different justifications, what brought people out into the streets in late May, in June of 2020? You know, the in particular, George Floyd being murdered. And I'm sure everybody had seen that video of a policeman with his knee on the back of his neck and him pleading out that he couldn't breathe. And, it, you know, that was a trigger, of course, but there had been so many similar incidents of, you know, Breonna Taylor and so many, the list goes on and I can't go through them all. But I think there was a moment where, you know, millions of people of all different races, enough is enough. And how do we bring attention to it? And people took to the streets to raise awareness about a specific real problem of disproportionate use of force against minorities. Whereas the Capitol attack was, you know, predicated on the stopping the steal, which we've referred to earlier that, you know, there isn't any, you know, even Mitch McConnell mentioned that you can't just make insinuations. You need to have evidence. And there wasn't any, you know, the 60 different court cases rejected that evidence. There wasn't any. So just the huge difference of the actual grievances. And then, you know, to see the cities, some cities and buildings and the police precinct on fire, I think it's fine. Like we can say that's wrong. I don't believe in looting a 7-Eleven or a Target or, you know, burning down anything, frankly. That's my belief. I think Joe Biden had, you know, said that and said unequivocally that that's wrong. Two things can both be wrong. It's not a zero sum game. So I really don't like the whataboutism for that reason. But again, if we're going to go down that road, attacking the Capitol, which is again the symbolic representation of our democracy and the literal place where members of Congress meet to, in this case, certify our election results, and attacking that peaceful transition of power is really not comparable to a 7-Eleven or a Target. But that being said, I think we, as political scientists, as scholars, as you know, intellectuals, we should, you know, have deep discussions about both events, but I'm just really, really concerned about the whataboutism that tries to just deflect and not allow us to investigate, in this case, the Capitol attack.
All right. Thank you. Big question. All right. An equally large question for you, Jeremy.
Okay.
Free speech. is it broken? And because other countries have versions of free speech, but not quite like Americans enshrined in the First Amendment free speech. And is this a social media problem or is this a larger problem? And again, try to keep us focused because I do want to move along to the rest of our topics. Thank you.
Ask me that giant question and then say, you know, So is free speech broken? Free speech is misunderstood, I think, today, and is, free speech, again, guaranteed in the First Amendment of the Constitution, right? The trouble that we're having here is that the term free speech is being thrown around a lot and being misused in a lot of cases. Just this last week, Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, wrote an op-ed for the New York Post talking about being muzzled, talking about how he's being silenced by big tech companies. And then, of course, he proceeded to go on and talk on Fox News and podcasts and published in one of the largest newspapers in the country about being muzzled. But that's another point. What's happened in this country and around the world, quite frankly, but particularly in this country, because of our unique relationship with free speech, is that what was once the public sphere, the public square, is now privately owned. Right. So when someone shuts down the Twitter account of the president, that seems like a violation of free speech, right? Because you're saying, okay, I'm not going to let them speak anymore. But by the law, they can do that. Twitter is a private company. Facebook is a private company. They can shut you down anytime. We used to talk about things before Facebook and Twitter, if you can remember that. We did, And then what has happened too, especially on the right, on the far right, is that they've gone on to other platforms, Parler and, Gab and some of these other ones. Well, look at Parler. Parler was being run on Amazon platform. And guess what? Amazon shut them down. And again, it's a private entity. So I don't really know the answer yet, but I don't feel comfortable with a company being able to do that, really. But it's within their right to do that. So we need to find a better way. We have to think about why were they shut down? And then the reason why was because they were spreading lies. They were spreading dangerous allegations that led to what we saw on the 6th. So, again, I'm trying to keep this as short as I can, but it's a huge issue, and it's a very complex issue because our media is so fractured these days. It used to be where, you would just read your newspaper or watch your TV and the government couldn't touch it, right? Because that was where free speech happened. But now it's happening everywhere, and it's happening in these little pockets that we don't always hear or see. So it's very difficult to do that, but it's a complex issue that we need to address, I think, especially in regards to social media. Social media, kind of to more directly answer your question, Troy, social media made this much more complex. I don't think it's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing that it did that. It just did, and we need to address it going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think your point about the fracturing is really important. Traditionally, the answer to wrong speech in the free speech arena is more speech. So right. Free speech works when you have a diversity of ideas and the best ideas rise to the top. But if we segment away ideas into pockets, now we don't have competing ideas. There's no competition. It's just I'm always right and you're always wrong, and that's it. I want to move along a little bit and focus. And let's just one question on the impeachment, because there's a couple that came up in the Q&A. On January 13th, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to impeachment. And I think just yesterday, the articles of impeachment were delivered to the Senate. And 2 weeks from today, the trial will begin. Why was it necessary, just in general, was it necessary to move forward with this impeachment, given that Donald Trump has left office? And I'll leave it just with that question.
Well, there's been a lot of debate about that, and I think I'll go on record of saying yes, impeachment isn't just about removal. It's also about setting a precedent and a standard of trying to prevent anything like this happening again. I don't think we'd want to get into a scenario where the last couple months and over 2 months in this case, from the election to the inauguration, where a president can just do whatever they want and not have to face any consequences for that. Going back to the political norms, I really think it's important that there's a line in the sand here, that this is, you know, repudiated, and you know, people who are involved in it, that there's consequences. And I think one of the things that can happen with that is it can prevent, in this case, former President Trump from running for president again. If there's a conviction, there can be a separate vote on banning from future federal office. I do know that, you know, hey, simultaneously, we're facing a pandemic, a really bad economy. The list goes on and on, right? So ideally, we'd have Congress be tackling these really urgent issues. So it's you know, does this take away some of the momentum from some of those big issues of being addressed? I think that's a fair question. I've read that there's some a movement to potentially censure the president, that I want to say Susan Collins and Tim Kaine are working together on maybe an alternative route of being able to essentially critique the president without having to go through a vote on impeachment.
And I'll just add to that, you know, the framers of the Constitution, they added in impeachment to remove someone from office, but also included in that is their disqualification for them for future office. So, you know, and that's a really important element here, of course, because we are talking about a former president. So, you know, when we hear that it's not constitutional, it is. And that's my take on it, at least, right? Because this is in the Constitution. And the framers believed that that was important enough to include that idea in there of disqualifying them for future office. And it's happened in the past. There was a Secretary of War in the 1800s or something like that who was impeached after leaving office for that very reason, to say, hey, we don't want them back. So there is a precedent, and there is a constitutional angle to this, but it certainly will be debated, like everything. So
yes. Okay, thank you. On January 20th, the 46th President of the United States, Joseph Biden, was sworn in. So to transition to inauguration, what message does Biden seem to be sending with this inauguration? And how is he trying to get, how does he want us to view his presidency at the beginning?
You know, I think the big word has been unity, of course, and there's been a lot of discussion about that. I think that he also is really pushing towards transparency. And those are incredibly lofty goals. And I think they're lofty goals for any president, but particularly in this moment. You know, it's something that, you know, he's been in an office, just a week now. But, you know, you're starting to learn some things about how things are operating, and you're definitely seeing the contrasts between this administration and the prior administration. But some are saying, how is the press secretary, Jen Psaki, how is she interacting with the press? Because that was always such a hotbed of controversy in that White House press room. And, you know, I've been watching those very closely. I think I've watched every press briefing. And I feel like for the most part, she's doing a good job, and it sounds like a normal press briefing that I was used to. It's kind of boring, and there's no heated, there's few heated confrontations. But here's the thing, the confrontations and those, maybe some tense questionings between members of the press and the press secretary or whoever is in that room representing the administration, that's a good thing. We want those. What we don't want is what we saw for the last 4 years, is where people are being berated and talked down to. And, you know, journalists are told that none of them care about religion. And that's not how that works. But the press is designed to challenge power. And that's what should happen in that room. So I think that, you know, by and large, thus far, the message of transparency is coming through in those little ways compared to the last administration, in my mind. And we'll continue to see that develop. But I think the message on Inauguration Day of unity and transparency, unity is certainly a lofty goal, but why not go after it? Why not try it and see? And time will tell if it'll prove itself out.
Yeah, I agree with what Jeremy said, and just add, I think leadership of competency, so things that Biden hopes to instill right away with his taking over the presidency in the first week, the seriousness of this office, making people feel like, you know, there's maturity. I'm just kind of lost of words how else to say it without being too denigrating to the former president. But I definitely think that he wants there to be a sense of calmness. You know, Jeremy mentioned, you know, to be boring. I think people could take boring would be good sometimes. You know, we don't need a day-to-day reality TV show with chaotic, you know, events. I think things are stressful enough. And being in a pandemic, I think they're pretty laser focused on, you know, trying to improve the vaccine rollout and trying to do whatever it takes to get the pandemic under control, hopefully by this summer. And of course, getting economic relief. So I think they're pretty focused on those, you know, to show that government can do big things to help the American people in times of crisis. And I just would add, if you look at the people he's surrounded himself with, everybody could critique a person here or there, but for the most part, I mean, I think it's a very competent, experienced, qualified group of people that he has surrounded himself with.
Yeah, I want to connect in a couple questions from the chat and the Q&A, and also with some of our questions. You know, what a big issue, there's someone that asked about the deep state and how do we rebuild trust and maybe convince, you know, pull some of that out. Like this belief in the deep state is driving people to do some of this, even though that deep state seems to not really exist. You know, one of the reasons we had Amy from psychology on this panel, and unfortunately she couldn't be here, is to talk a little bit about that psychology of belief and, you know, like how do we engage in the ideas of belief. And, you know, it seems like the Biden administration, one message he seems to be sending is that it's okay to disagree. We can have disagreement, but it's how we disagree is seems to be what we've lost. And that takes a belief in our process, in a belief in our system. And so I'd like to just maybe throw it out to whoever wants to take it, put on your psychology hat, and our psychologists can correct us later. You know, how can we address some of this loss of belief that we see in our voters and in our fellow citizens?
I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is, you know, the loss of belief in the system stems back to voters and, you know, citizens feeling as though they are being slighted in some way, or they're feeling, you know, there's a lot of victimhood going on, and that's a big driver. And I think a big driver of some of this, some of the deep state and some of the fringe thinking is fear, because they see a country changing, and they see a country, you know, that is moving very quickly in certain directions that they're not familiar with. And that's scary. And I think it's a natural feeling to be fearful of that. Change can be very scary. It's how we react to it that really matters, right? And something that I think about a lot, and I think that I think it's really important, is that, you know, truth is not subjective, right? Truth is truth. And we have to remember that when we're moving forward and we're starting to discuss these ideas. You know, democracy was never really intended to be a great unifier. It wasn't designed to make us all think the same way. But what democracy is at its core is designed to allow us to have a conversation I think it was just a couple of days ago when President Biden was asked, you know, what does unity mean to you? And he said, and I'm paraphrasing him here, that it was, you know, debate without the vitriol, you know, without this nastiness. And that's what we've seen so much of, you know, in the last 4 years, that has really caused a great deal of damage, and I think led to what we saw on January 6th. So it's getting back to this sort of, you know, deliberative democracy, which has always been kind of a pipe dream. But, you know, again, we can strive for it, you know, and aim for it, where we can have conversations and disagree with some decorum and some respect. We've lost that. And I think it's really important to get back to it, or at least try to.
Yeah, I think this is a really big question that would require a lot of time to respond to. So I'll do the best I can in a short time. And the question, as I'm reading it, about media and the deep state and how we can rebuild trust. I don't want to critique journalism too much, but I do think that, you know, that I agree with everything Jeremy said about the media being an important pillar of our democracy. We'd like to think of them as a fourth branch of government, another check and balance. But over the last few decades, I wouldn't call the media fake. I think that that's a wrong way of referring to them, for sure. But sensationalism and sometimes, you know, are they really setting the agenda properly? When I say they, the media is just so, you know, so many different diverse media outlets. It's hard to be precise with that. But I do think that we in journalism, as higher education instructors, the list goes on and on. We have to do better to try to educate our citizens, to build that trust. And citizens have to take the time to be good consumers of information, seek out trusted sources, and to, you know, not share information that is fake and misleading and so forth. But I definitely think that, you know, we're at historic lows of trust in government. And so I think it's easy to just be cynical and think that, you know, that there's a deep state, or that, you know, there's conspiracies and so forth. I do think that the climate is easy to be susceptible to that. So I'll cut it off there. There's a lot I'd like to say, but I know we're down to like 12 minutes too.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe down the road, we need to have an event that really dives into the psychology a lot more, because the changing people's minds is very difficult once beliefs are locked in. And the thing with human beliefs is that they perpetuate themselves. So you get, you know, your cycles of confirmation bias, where you ignore the information that could change your mind and only focus on the information that already agrees with you. And I think that's one of the challenges of social media. I think along with that, so this is my soapbox a little bit, is that we are increasingly living in this country, not just in gerrymandered political districts, like congressional districts, but we are self-sorting ourselves. So if you are a Democrat, you're more likely to move into a certain geography of your state, mostly urban or near suburbs. And if you're going to vote as a Republican, you're more likely to live in the far out suburbs or rural America. And people are purposely moving. So it's not just like how we're cutting our lines, but we're doing it to ourselves. We're self-sorting. There's a lot of interesting research out there about that. And so I worry about that too, where now you're going to have a setup where you have urban versus rural, north versus south, these kind of tensions that again, one of the best ways to break down beliefs is to meet people who think differently from you and to broaden your own friend circle to learn about other people. But if you don't live with those other people, it becomes harder and harder to do. And again, like you said, it's very, very, very complicated. A couple more questions. Going back to the January 6th insurrection, do you think the lack of security was due to the fact that they did not think it would get to this point? There was talk in other areas of riots or fights, but nothing ever came from that. That was a question in the chat.
Well, I think that one of the things that is interesting to think about is how the mindset of the security personnel and leadership may have had a little bit of a bias themselves of what the true threat was and who the people were and how threatening they may see them. I think that this is one of the reasons for the impeachment process, I think, to play out too. I would like a real deep dive into what exactly happened and how this was so easy for that group to be able to, because it was seemingly was fairly predictable that there was a lot of anger and telling them to show up. And the fact that some police, I don't want to say, as investigations unfold, it seems that some people didn't show up and called in and I think it's concerning and worthy of a deep investigation of how easily people were able to get into the Capitol. And I think it's an easy, when we get into that whataboutism, to juxtapose that with the scenes from, let's say, June 1st, where the Capitol was much more protected. And of course, there was National Guard and other military personnel who went quite forceful after protesters. So we just saw a very different response. But again, that's a topic that I'm going to save for February with a separate event for those who are interested.
Jeremy, do you want to comment or want me to move on to the next question?
Yeah, I know there's a couple other questions, so you can go ahead and move on. I think Kevin covered it well.
Yeah, good. Okay. One that I do want to hit, we're running out of time, but this is important. Can we talk about QAnon? I'm not very informed on it, but the headlines seem to be different from the actual story, from what I understand. So could you help iron out what is this, the big Q? Who are they? What is this about? And it keeps coming up in media.
Yeah. Yeah, QAnon, I don't want to tell you to go Google search of it because it's kind of wild. But it is this this group that's led by Q, and you know it's an entire kind of networked conspiracy theory that there are actors, political actors, who are hiding pedophilia. There's a lot of different layers to it. I think that it's hard for mainstream journalism to kind of get its head around it almost. And I feel like a lot of outlets don't want to give it oxygen. But on January 6th, it really arrived, literally, on the doorstep of our country. Because so many of those who have been arrested and who took part in the insurrection had QAnon sympathize with QAnon. And I think what was really fascinating is a lot of QAnon QAnon believers really thought something was going to happen January 20th that was not the inauguration. I saw a piece, I think it was on the New York Times. I may not be remembering that correctly, but some of them said after the 20th, I need to reevaluate my life. Like they literally have to like change their entire mindsets because they're very much indebted to that. And not indebted, but embedded into that thinking. So it's a very wild conspiracy and kind of a really, I'm going to say, fascinating group, but also very dangerous. And we saw that danger come to fruition on the 6th.
Kevin, do you want to add anything to that?
No, that was well said.
Okay. Another question. President Reagan famously said in the 80s that government is not the solution to the problem, but it is the cause of our problems. Do you see a connection between the core tenet of American conservatism and the insurrection at the Capitol? So this is asking us to stretch out our view a little bit longer. What do you think?
Well, I think fundamentally there's a lot of inherent conflicts with the principles of our government and what we expect of government. I mean, I think we want, various groups want government to help make our lives better, protect us, ensure equality. And that's tough to do when you've got a limited government. You know, if you're going back to Reagan, then the idea that government is big enough that you can, or small enough that you can drown it in the bathtub mentality, then of course we're not going to be well equipped to take on, COVID and, major economic issues, climate change, civil unrest issues, the list goes on and on. So I think that's a real, issue that we have to grapple with of, we have low trust in government, but what do we want government to do? And what expectations do we have of them? What do we consider successful? I think with so much access to information and some of the quite poor information, it's really easy to find one example of incompetency or bad behavior by a government official and then just have a cynical view. We don't see, government isn't great at marketing their successes, and we fail to see all the positives of, what government would be like. And if we didn't have much government, there's examples of that in Sudan and other places in the world where, the government's very small and ineffective. And I don't think those are places you'd want to live. So I think we have a lot of inconsistent beliefs on what government should be. And of course, this modern world that is so complicated and has a lot of really significant modern problems, I think makes it easier for government to be critiqued.
And I'll just add to that, that notion, what Reagan said, that quote, the government is not the solution to our problems, it is the cause of our problems. When that was said, I was around and I've heard this clip, before, that was a statement that we could debate. And, you can read that now and almost picture someone chanting that or yelling that in the halls of the Capitol. It just, that statement reminds me of just how we've taken things like this and they've become so extreme. This is a wonderful question from Jess. This is a great question, one that we can discuss and debate. But I think there are folks who have taken something like this and not only made it more extreme, but then, like we saw in the sixth, acted on it. So it again, it's taken some of these principles. I think there has been a lot of conservative values that have, and even, liberal values, and this happens with it when we're on extreme sides of the political spectrum, they get sort of hijacked and pulled from their context and stretched out to the edges. And I think this is kind of an example. You think about, okay, if there's a problem, I'm going to go solve it. Now there's this thing, okay, there's a problem, I'm going to go destroy it. That's very different. So I think this is, it's a great question because it speaks to kind of how far we've come from what were conservative values that you may disagree or agree with. But, it's gone so extreme now.
Yeah. One thing I would add on this idea about government is that a lot of the government that really impacts our lives is some of the most accessible government to us. And it's our alderman, if you're in the city, or our village trustees, or the board of education. So probably a lot of the people on this call or on this this panel or our audience go to Moraine Valley. How many of you have ever spoken with one of the 7 board of trustees members that runs our college? They're elected officials. And if you emailed them, I guarantee you that they would email you back, right? I mean, these are people that aren't paid and are really glorified volunteers in a lot of ways. No one's getting rich out of being a trustee member at Moraine Valley or your local village official. But they're also the most accessible people. So the more that you participate in government and that you're talking to these officials, the more that you understand how government works. And you see the levels of expertise and the levels of care at all levels of our government. And government's not perfect, and there's definitely people bending the system. So, we can in Illinois debate the benefits of Mike Madigan or the problems of Mike Madigan, but he doesn't represent most government officials, right? And I think that's the thing that really, I see people that really care and are really giving their times, and they're getting lumped together as these kind of evil people, and they're really not. And so that's one thing I would leave with our audience, is to take some time to get to know. I know we're at time. I want to ask one more question, and then we can wrap this up. Just to looking into the future, a question from Maria. What are some of the biggest changes that we should expect to see within the duration of our next presidency, within the Biden administration? Where are we going?
As far as policies, I think I'm hopeful that, you know, by fall of this year, that hopefully the pandemic will be manageable and we will be able to go to schools in person, and in many cases, and go to stores and go to restaurants. I think that's a really key aspect that leads to so many other parts of, you know, economic growth, of what they can do to help, you know, improve unemployment. And so I think that's, you know, fundamentally, that will be kind of the way that this administration's judged, is how well they're able to and how quickly that this pandemic can be addressed.
And I would say, you know, I agree with what Kevin said. And also, just as I mentioned before, just this dialing down the temperature of our rhetoric and our, you know, the vitriol that was present for so many years. Will it all go away? No. But I think it will help to have someone at the top who doesn't tend to peddle in that. Now, does he get mad and say things and will cause controversy? Of course. I mean, that's a president, but we just, the degree we saw it the last 4 years, was off the charts. And I hope people understand what a unique presidency, the Trump era was. So my hope is that the temperature comes down a little bit, but what really needs to happen is we all need to become better consumers of media. We need to understand where our news and our information comes from, what is their motivation, what are their sources, their reputation. Because if we don't do that, it doesn't really matter who's in office. You know, it really doesn't. So, you know, we are a government of the people. And so we need to be good citizens. We need to take care of this democracy. It isn't up to, quite frankly, we don't, you know, elect a president and say, okay, you take care of democracy, right? That's up to us. And I think that's something maybe I hope that came through in the last 4 years, that we can look at and say, okay, this still is a great experiment. And it is still quite fragile. We as people need to do a better job of taking care of it. And one way we can do that, one of the many ways we can do that, Troy mentioned getting more involved. You know, and I think that starts with your information and seeking out good information and verifying your information. It's vitally important, and being mindful of what you share and what you consume. You know, we need to do a much better job of that, no matter who's in office.
I love that. And I was wanting to say something similar earlier, but just to end with, for at least for myself, if we're a government of, by, and for the people, and we distrust government and we hate government, what is that? I mean, we're a fundamental part of the equation. And just to reiterate to Jeremy's point, our responsibilities in this system are immense. And so play our part.
That is a great ending note. So I want to give a special thank you to Jeremy, who's in California, and this is very, very early for him. So thank you for getting up for us. Thank you for our audience. And I'll just say, I think, you know, for all of us, knowledge matters and ideas matter. And so thank you for being that. We challenge you to be part of the ideas in the future. So, okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Sir.